It's on?
Yes. Okay.
So when you're ready, it'd be fun for you guys to just hang out and entertain each other so I don't have to give a Dharma talk at all. But if you want to just reconvene now. So, some time ago, I was wandering around in my house feeling a little agitated and wanting somehow or other to change my state. I know that you have been in those situations every now and then, how to change how we feel at the moment. And to get some wisdom, and I didn't necessarily want to go to my zafu. So my zafu, my sitting cushion. So I went to the computer. Oh God, yes. And, you know, YouTube is a wonderful resource for lots of things, and there's lots and lots of spiritual teachers who give wonderful talks on YouTube from all kinds of traditions, all kinds of slices of the belief pie. And I saw somebody that I hadn't heard in a long time, a wonderful Tibetan teacher who's now dead, Chogyam Trungpa, who came over in the early 60s and did so much in the West to prepare us for the Dharma according to the Tibetan tradition, and so that we could actually revere the Dalai Lama to the extent that he deserves. It was because of Chogyam Trungpa that we were prepared and ripened to receive that kind of wisdom. So there on YouTube was a talk by Chogyam Trungpa, and it was on wisdom. And I had been reflecting for some time on what is really the specific step-by-step relationship, the causal chain between sati, what we do, this practice of paying attention, non-judgmentally, open to receive whatever arises from the mind and the body, sati. The relationship between paying attention, cultivating insight, and being wise. What are those three things? How do they relate? What's going on? How do they transform one into the other? So I was very, very eager to hear Chogyam Trungpa talk about wisdom. And I was still a little agitated, a little restless, you know, one of the five hindrances. Mine is agitation and restlessness. And predominantly, I have others too. And he started out kind of, you know, how it is when you start out a Dharma talk, a room, preparing his robe, the things that monks do, looking around, deciding where he wanted to start his talk. And finally, he gets into it. And he says, well, what is wisdom? Wisdom is the ability to discern, discernment. Let me give you an example, he said. When you go to the grocery store and you select out what you put in your basket to take home as food. So I thought, well, you know, this isn't really what I was prepared to hear, going to the grocery store, picking out what kind of bread I want and the things that I want to bring home to eat. This isn't very profound. This is Chogyam Trungpa being unprofound. And that was really in response to my agitation. And so I turned the computer off and said, I'm just going to go take a walk. But in the very interesting, indescribable power of a true teacher, Trungpa had put a seed in my mind and it started working. And over the next couple of days, I couldn't help but notice that something about his silly metaphor of going shopping really spurred me on to reflect on how do I practice discernment? What is the most immediate, impactful way that I practice discernment, not just when I'm sitting, but on a day-to-day, moment-by-moment basis? What was he really pointing to? And I realized it was discernment of what the contents of my mind is. And the more I reflected on it, the more I realized that this is a very, very subtle but powerful way of understanding and gaining insight into one of the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Truth called Anicca, that nothing is permanent, everything is insubstantial. And I had the kind of lyrical image of my mind and thoughts in the mind as a feather riding on the surface of the ocean. Wouldn't it be nice if we could discern, pick and choose what we're going to put in our basket of thoughts that we will eat and reflect on and build on, and they define our experience and they define our relationship to ourselves and to others powerfully. Or like some of the license plate tags say, you know, don't believe your thoughts. Well, it's easy to say that. But what does it really mean to be in a state of discernment in relation to our subjective moment-to-moment experience so that it doesn't really happen to us and lock us in and imprison us in all kinds of waterfalls of experience in our minds and our bodies? So there is a story, it's actually a Japanese Zen story, but it could be any monks in any tradition. Two monks were walking through the woods. And, you know, the monk's life is stipulated by lots and lots and lots of rules. And one of the rules is that you don't touch a woman. So here these two monks are walking along this meadow and walking along a creek, and the creek begins to be a little wider and it turns into a river, and there is a peasant woman on one side of the bank, and she obviously is befuddled because she needs to get to the other side of the river. She's got some things that she wants to take to market so that she can make a little bit of money and bring food back to her family. And the one monk is full of the conditions, all the thoughts, all the beliefs that have been inculcated. You're not supposed to do this. You're not supposed to do that. You see the woman by the side of the road. Now bring your attention back to quiet, empty mind. And the other one is not distressed and disturbed by what you could call his conditioning. He sees the woman where she is, what her situation is, and it's simple. He just goes, picks her up, and carries her across to the other side of the river, and both monks go across that way. He puts her down, and she says, thank you very much, and continues on her way to the market. And the monk who didn't pick up the woman looks at the monk who did and says, you know we're not allowed to do that. I'm going to go. I'm going to tell the head monk. I'm going to tell the teacher. Or you're going to get sent up, you know, or sent down, as they say in Britain. Because you're not supposed to touch a woman, and you know that. And I'm going to report you. And the monk looks at him and says, oh, really? I dropped the woman off on this side of the river, and you are still carrying her. So what does this have to do with wisdom and the transience of thoughts and the insubstantiality of the conditioning that we carry around, burdened by all the rules and regulations that we have been learning since day one? That when we don't have the burden of those conditions and we don't bear down on our perceptions of what is present and obviously easily can be done, to just flow from one act to another freely, like this monk did. Saw the situation, knew he could do something about it, did it, and then let it go. Didn't think about it, didn't burden himself with the thoughts, didn't wonder, oh my God, the other monk has witnessed me, I'm going to be in trouble now. None of that clouded his mind. Even if the thought arose, he just let it arise and then he let it dissolve. Knowing the power of thoughts and the effects that they have on our emotions and on our bodies, wouldn't it be nice if we could take the thoughts that arise a little less seriously and begin to just have them dissolve so that we can choose what we believe? What are the contents of our subjective experience? Rather than just letting thoughts run our experience. Isn't this a discernment that Trungpa was referring to? And how does this relate to insight and paying attention and wisdom? So when we practice paying attention, when we practice sati, we are actually having an impact on our mind-body process. At first, it feels like it heightens our experience of how tight our bodies are and how fast our minds are racing and how confused our emotions are. That's the first thing. It gives us direct, immediate contact with the state of things in the moment. Very easy to see when we're sitting in meditation practice that the condition of our body affects how we feel, what we say to ourselves, what we think, discouraging thoughts, self-defeating thoughts. You know, oh my God, I can't do this. Oh, I should have. Oh, I'm not ready. Oh, I'll never. You know those thoughts. And you know that so in the meditation practice, we have the opportunity to see and experience the direct relationship between the state of our body and the feelings and emotions and thoughts that arise from that. And in turn, it is circular. It's a chicken and the egg thing. What comes first, body states or thoughts and feelings? Who knows? But they feed each other. So when we're not in a sitting practice, or having some kind of disease process make us uncomfortable, we don't pay much attention to what's going on in our bodies. We're just really grateful. Most of the time, we don't even feel grateful that the body is functioning, it's healthy, it's not calling attention to us. It's just doing what it's supposed to do. But we are paying attention to powerful thoughts because they do affect us emotionally. And these thoughts seem to be so definitive. I'm not great. She's not great. I'm not doing a good job. Oh my God, did I prepare enough for tomorrow's presentation? Did I have a good childhood? Was I kind to that person? Is that person kind to me? What does this say about me? And if you notice, the thoughts are continually creating an illusion of defining us. And these definitions are not things that we are happy with most of the time. So sati brings us to the immediate contact with our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, and then our body states. The result of practicing sati over a period of time is a calming down of the engine that runs that process, that runs the cycle of body states, emotions, feelings, and thoughts, slows it down, calms it down, even creates what we might call a space of silence every now and then. It's such a gift, which we run away from. And when we do allow for that relaxation and that dispersing of the speed and the chaos and the emotional stories that we're telling ourselves, the narratives, the movies we star in, then we have an opportunity to gain some insight, because as the mind calms down, we can see more deeply, we can see more clearly, we can see to the underlying truths that are not conditioned by our temporal momentum, our movements. And what does this have to do with wisdom? Well, interestingly enough, most of the time, people put wisdom at the end of the thing. You know, when you reach the top of the mountain, that's when you're wise. But what Trungpa was alluding to was something more subtle, unexpected, and in a way more profound. That wisdom precedes attention and insight, as well as fulfills it at the end. It is an act of wisdom. Every single one of us has performed an act of wisdom to come and sit for 40 minutes because it invites the process of insight. Discerning what it is that we allow as thoughts, which thoughts we will follow. You know how it is when you have a thought, something happens. Let's think about when you get an email or you get a call or you get a text. It confronts you. It confronts you. It creates emotions. And these emotions are conditioned by the ways that we have experienced the past and the beliefs and the presuppositions that we have built up from those. I know that we have this experience many times a day. Somebody has a certain tone of voice that is meaningful to us. And immediately we tell the story. Oh my God, I must have really offended them last night when we went out together. Or, oh, now they really understand that there's something really not very, very nice about me. Or, so these thoughts arise. And there are all kinds of narratives associated with these thoughts. We could all write at least 20 novels with the narratives that have been stimulated by the random occasions that visit us from moment to moment, not only while we're awake, but also while we're asleep in our dreams. So what if, as these thoughts arise and threaten to put us in these prisons of feeling horrible about ourselves or feeling suspicious or feeling paranoid or feeling like we haven't done it well enough or, you know, we're being judged or, you know, this has been true all of my life, I'm never going to be good enough for this, or all those kinds of, you know, castigating thoughts that don't create a lot of happiness or flexibility or even truthful understanding of who we are? What if we could just see them arise and let them go, like a feather riding on the surface of the ocean? I know that there are times when you sit, when you have that experience, when you can see a thought arising and building itself, you know, get some momentum. But then you've practiced enough sati that it seems to disperse before you can really hang a whole story onto it. I know you've all had that experience. So the question is, can we have that experience while we're shopping, as if we're going grocery shopping? Oh, no, there, here comes that thought. I'm just going to let it go. Here comes that old proverb about who I am and how horrible it all is about me. I'm just going to let it go. Now, what is a, you know, that does help create an ecology, an internal ecology that is more inviting to being happy, being relaxed, not being so judgmental, and being able to just flow a little better through our day-to-day lives and have more resources available because they're not getting burned out in criticism. And, you know, criticism is a really hot fire. But the other benefit of it is that when we realize this, and we realize this within ourselves through experiencing it, we also know that this is true of other people. So we liberate ourselves from being terribly concerned what other people think of us. Because we know that these are just conditioned by whatever experiences they've had throughout their lives and whatever stimulus has brought these thoughts up. I'm not saying that we shouldn't pay attention to each other. I'm not saying that we should close off to each other. I'm simply saying we don't have to be so distressed and so profoundly agitated by how other people respond to us or what they might think about us. And isn't that a liberation? Doesn't that create the space for true mutual acknowledgement without so much fear of being judged, of being rejected, of being criticized? What about if we reflect on our parents that way? Whatever they did with us or limited our expansiveness as people. What if we understand that they really held on to their beliefs and their thoughts as they were trained and educated in their schools, by their society, by their families? And that we don't have to be so plagued. You know, when we were kids, we didn't have mindfulness like we have now. Well, that's, you know, you're very, very exceptional. But you don't have to be plagued. We don't have to be plagued by these things any longer. It's a real, what they call enlightenment, in the sense if you feel immediately lighter, if we give ourselves half a chance to shop and be discerning. What is it that we want to settle into as beliefs, and which do we want to just release and let go? And if we have this process going on in us, others are doing it to some extent or other as well. And if they're locked into judgment, that is their suffering. Do we want their suffering to be absorbed by us too? Do we want to struggle with being defined by other people's inability to let their judgments and their thoughts come and go like a feather riding on the surface of the ocean? So I realized that really is what Trungpa was referring to, because for about four, five days, honestly, that seed of going shopping for groceries as a metaphor for the discernment that leads to wisdom worked its way into reflecting on this in such a way that I really felt myself more than ever before encouraged and inspired to seriously, seriously undertake that as a practice, whether I was sitting on a cushion or doing anything else. That this was really an understanding of a deep, reflective insight into the nature of insubstantiality. Because we could say that everything is insubstantial, but it's all standing solid around us. We could say that our bodies are insubstantial, but here they are, at least for the next 10 minutes. They're kind of, everything is flowing, they're breathing, cells are dying, cells are being born. But for the most part, our experience of it is that there's some kind of substantiality to it. But when we get to the mind and the emotional states and the relationship between emotions and mind, we can literally invite a complete, direct, liberating, enlightening experience that the mind is simply like the moving of the ocean, and whatever is written on it can dissolve as quickly as the next wave dissolves what was the surface of the ocean a moment ago. So it turns out that wisdom isn't necessarily being able to pronounce truths and tell the world what you're supposed to believe and what you're not supposed to believe and how you're supposed to act and what you do with yourself and what you do with others. It's not, that isn't really the wisdom that Trungpa was pointing to. What Trungpa was pointing to was the direct and immediate experience of the insubstantiality of the mind feeling body process. And when the body is tight, or when the body is going through its changes, because it is a little more invested in the so-called material realm than the electrical synapses that are going on in the brain. And remember, the brain extends the nerves that emerge from the brain and go through the top of the spine, radiate out to the ends of our fingers and toes. So our whole body is an electrical field. But if we pay attention to our thoughts, we can have a very immediate understanding of the insubstantiality of that which creates our experience from moment to moment. We can discern, and in that way, we can be choosing. So discernment and wisdom means you make the right choice. Some thoughts really do emerge from the deeper, quieter place, and they can be called insights. But most thoughts are just affected by our emotional body and by the neurophysiology of our brain and the biochemistry that moves through our brain and into the amygdala and creates those alarms that set us on edge. So what if wisdom is simply knowing how to discard, let that thought go, let that feeling go, let that thought go, let that feeling go. Realizing that most thoughts, all thoughts, arise from the conditions of our biochemistry. So when we're sitting and we're uncomfortable, the thoughts that we have are not very nice thoughts, right? I'm not a good meditator. I don't have good karma. I'm never going to get this. Or you go into yoga and you try to get into a position and the messages from your body affect everything that you think, right? Like, oh my God, how long do I have to hold this? This is impossible. She's tormenting us. She's making us hold this so that we can really get into our agony, so that we can say our bodies are really rigid and your body is such a sexy flowing one. Poor us. Lucky you. We'll never be you. So really, we have less control over what our body's conditions are from moment to moment. But the thoughts and the feelings that arise from those conditions, we can recognize and we can dissolve. And thereby gain wisdom as opposed to feed what's called the vicious cycle of suffering. So, that's my talk. Yeah. So I don't know that what I want to do is present truth. What I would like to do is present this talk as in the form of inquiry. When we inquire, is this your experience? Is this something you can relate to? Is this something you've come across yourself? Is this something that is useful? So I ask you. Yeah. The Dharma talks that you have come to over the last couple of weeks all relate to insecurity. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You don't care what other people think. You don't care how other people see you. You never do. Well, you know, you could say you're a lucky girl. you are a very... Yeah, yeah. Well, let me ask you a question. Did you say that you're a very judgmental person? Okay. So do you find that, who is it, but you exclusively judge others? You don't judge yourself? Not as much. Okay. Okay. Yeah. 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 So let me ask you a question. When you find, you did open this. When you find yourself judging other people, you said, I wish I didn't, but I do. So do you find that when you judge other people that it creates some kind of discomfort for you? Sometimes. So those times that it does, would it be good for you to practice dropping the judgment and seeing if your relationship with that person shifts or changes in a way that feels more easeful for you? So, it's absolutely true that some people are very, very sensitive to how other people see them, and some people just don't care at all and have a lot of self-regard. You could say you're more psychologically healthy. But there's a rigidity where you are too, and you have hinted at it because you do feel uncomfortable about being judged, or you wouldn't be here. You feel uncomfortable about being the judge. And you realize maybe that there is a limitation that it creates in your ability to be with other people or to learn from them or to be comfortable or to love them. And so part of what you might do as a practice is see if those judgments, what happens to you if you see the judgments arise and then you just let them drop? Because judging is one of those thought forms that can create a lot of anguish. And it really, bottom line, doesn't matter whether what you're doing is judging others or having that projection that others are judging you. The experience is still an experience of judgmental thinking. And so I inquire to you, is that judgmental thinking process helpful to you? Does it cause you suffering? Would you like to dissolve it a little bit or make it more workable? Not make it so automatic. Would that help you in your life, in your work, in your love life, in your relationships with people, with reality, whatever aspect of reality? And if that's true, then what you can take from this talk is the thought that maybe you can, the judging thoughts, the judging mind is the mind that you can release, loosen up a little bit. What would happen if you allow those judgments to dissolve? You might practice that. So that's simply noticing, just simply noticing when the judgment arises, which is a form of paying attention, which is a form of sati. And then you might reflect on that there is a body state. There's something about what is going on with you and that other person that is making you uncomfortable, physiologically uncomfortable. And that it is that body state that arises into judgment. And in that judgment, you push that person away in an attempt to regain your sense of comfort. And if you watch that cycle, then you have some say in whether you want to rifle through those cycles as they arise or whether you want to discern, have some discernment, and cut that cycle and see what happens if you start loosening it up. See if it supports more well-being for you. Would you do it? Would you do? That's it. You know that. Yes, exactly. So there you go. So it's never. So there you go. Now you've just given me another little tag. It's rarely comfortable to be the source of other people's discomfort. So by the time it comes out of your mouth, it's already been a thought. And if it's a thought, then it's probably a thought that has recurred. You know, it's kind of been there. It's a file you have on this person, and you've made this report in this file numerous times, you know? So what you want to do is just simply say, well, that's a hard-boiled view of this person. What if I just let it go? What if I just let it go for a second? And if I don't let it go, just notice the impact that it has when you are in judgment, especially if you express it and you notice that the other person hears it. And then you see, my God, I've created a cycle of suffering. Is it true? Is this person really stupid? Or is this just my way of creating distance with this person, making me uncomfortable? So even if you can't catch, you know, some people say this practice is like a, you know, is like being a cat on the floor against the wall, looking at the mouse hole, waiting for the mouse to come out. You know, that when I was taught how to practice this, that was one of the metaphors that was given to me. It isn't so great in the long run because it makes people very tense and very, it's kind of like you're in the army now, you know. Don't let a moment slip by that you're not paying attention, because that might be the very moment that the mouse comes out and you miss it. So that's a little too tight. But if you loosen it up a little bit, then it becomes, pay attention. If you don't catch it, if the mouse goes out and you know, it escapes out of your mouth before you have an opportunity to cool down your thinking and your body and step back and just not be too reactive, that's okay too. You can actually practice awareness at every part of a behavior. It doesn't have to be at the beginning. It doesn't have to be in the middle. It can also be at the end, and the effect that it has. So wherever you wake up in the course of a response is perfectly fine. It's not a third-class wake-up just because you're waking up after you've already, you know, let it come out of your mouth. So any point on that behavioral curve, on that behavioral arc, that you say, oh, my God, what's going on here? That's the wake-up. That's the awakening that the word Buddha, the awakened one, relates to. For us people who are not Buddhas, except deep inside, we can awaken at any given moment, and it has the power of bringing insight and wisdom to us at that particular moment of wakefulness. Because you have admitted that it's something that you're uncomfortable with, and you certainly don't have the intention of hurting other people. Not only because you're compassionately involved in caring for them, but also when other people are hurt, it makes you uncomfortable even more so. And it's probably not your intention to make anyone feel bad. So it's your behavior that is creating that misery. So for you, it's the same thing. Watch your mind, watch your thoughts, don't believe them, don't take them so in hand like they're concrete truths. Question them. Think of your mind as a feather riding on the surface of the ocean. And thank you for being so courageous to admit. Yeah. Yeah.
I want to be a bit tired at this point. Thank you.
Yes, thanks. Yes.
And growing up with a disability.
Yes.
It really quite embedded in me.
Yes. Right. Yes.
And how I've been able to tease it out the other day, I was in a real fancy restaurant with a good friend of mine, and we had this really nice waiter. And of course, my friend and I were being lecture adult women and commenting on attractiveness, but I did notice at one point that I would ask a question and that waiter would look at my friend and answer her, and that's a dynamic that I've dealt with all my life. I asked the question, it was pretty intelligent answer, please. Answer me, and not the person next to me. And so I've been able to say, okay, that dynamic is going on. It's that thing.
It's that.
Their discomfort.
Yes.
Because they can't understand me, and they don't know how to deal with it.
Yes. Yes. There you go. Yes. 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 Yes, yes. Uncomfortable. Right.
And so I figured that's who I am, but how to stop the suffering from it, because it doesn't own me.
Yes.
So I've been, and thanks to meditation, I've been able to work through that.
Right. Wow. 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 Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Is she still here? Okay. Yeah. It's hard to hear. It's a beautiful, beautiful recounting of the experience that other people have judgments because we might be impacted by different conditions, and so we look different or we act different, how long it's taken you to not be hurt, to not be angry, to not feel judged, to not feel like an outsider, to not feel like a freak, and to place it back on the other person, that it's their thoughts, their attempt to understand, their attempt to reorient somehow, rather than having it affect you hurtfully. And that this is really the kind of practice, yeah, that I'm talking about. Because when you can separate out from your own judgment and your own reactivity, then you can look at other people's reactivity and judgments in a different way, with more space. You can allow it to happen. And it doesn't necessarily affect you, and you don't necessarily judge them for being judgmental. and that this is a fruit of your practice over 4 years of meditation.
Four.
Four. 40. Four. Yes. Yes. 4:40, what's the difference? It's just time. You know, sometimes a 40-minute sitting feels like 40 years. Oh my God. That's why they walked out. We're over the time. We're over the time. They're not being offensive. They're just saying, hey, it's 9 o'clock. It's over. So let's just, so you see, there you go. Even I can't afford to practice what I preach. So it's very nice being with you. We don't have time for a last minute meditation, but, just remember that it can give you a lot of space and a lot of ease to not take your mental and emotional life too specifically, seriously, like it's the absolute truth of the moment. Liberate yourselves from that because it's highly conditioned. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Yvonne. You always enjoy your talks. That was a wonderful talk. I want to just make a brief announcement about Mission Dharma. If you haven't been here, welcome. If you're new to the group, please come back. We do have a happiness hour the second Tuesday of the month, which was tonight. So we will hopefully invite you more in the future to those. We're trying to make those announcements in advance so you can join us for conversation and introductions before we sit. And we have a practice of generosity that allows us to continue to meet here each week. Your contribution to our rent, which is $150 a week, allows us to be here next week and on and on and on. And also, we practice Teacher Donna, so any contributions you can make to the basket for the teacher will support Yvonne or whoever is taking the seat, and we really appreciate your generosity. There are different ways you can do that as well. You can write a check for St. John the Evangelist Church if you'd like a tax deduction. You can make it out to St. John the Evangelist Church and put Mission Dharma on the memo line. That will allow us to pay the rent that way. Cash, we have PayPal on our website, all different forms. So thank you so much. We hope to see you again. And any help putting the chairs and cushions away would be greatly appreciated as well. Good night.
I prepared. I worked on it. Oh, good. See? I was thinking, okay.